Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, we'll have news about an East County police chief who has announced he is retiring. We'll also have an update on efforts by local elected officials to convince the Forest Service to let its firefighting planes land at the Ramona Airfield. On Friday, two highways in East County faced extended shutdowns, including one that lasted over 10 hours, trapping motorists in 100-degree heat. We'll tell you why, and why some residents are speaking out to voice anger over the lack of notification to keep motorists safe and delays in response times that may have put lives at risk. We'll also have news about a tragic mid-air collision near Brown Field in Otay Mesa Sunday. Our newsmakers today are from the Diego Valley Charter School, and they'll be telling us about their efforts to help a diverse student population attain success, as well as about a new film called Chaldean Voices that will be debuting locally soon. Today, we'll also re-air our interviews with the Jamul Indians' new tribal chairwoman, as well as the casino director. It's the end of an era in East County with the passing of Gary McClintock, a world-famous saddle maker who lived in Descanso. Today, we'll replay our Sounds of History interview, recorded 2 years ago with Mr. McClintock, talking about the craft of making saddles for trail riders and cowboys. On our education report, learn why the state of California is being sued over its records regarding English language learners. Hear about the fate of a lost horse named Daisy in Alpine, or rather a horse statue, and about job opportunities for senior drivers being offered through Uber. Learn about student filmmakers at San Diego State who've been nominated for an Emmy Award. And hear about openings on La Mesa's Advisory Commission. Get tips for how to dig safely from SDG&E, plus learn why many wildfires are sparked by vehicles and what you can do to make sure your vehicle does not start a fire. Plus, find out why the price of eggs is going up and what some exasperated restaurant owners are doing as a result. We'll have all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. El Cajon Police Chief Jim Redman has announced plans to retire on December 4th. Chief Redman has served as chief since 2011 and has been a member of the city's police force since 2008. El Cajon City Manager Doug Williford has said that the crime rate dropped 25% with Redman at the helm. He also credits Redman with community-based policing that shows sensitivity to El Cajon's increasingly diverse community, the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. Chief Redman, an El Cajon resident himself, told KUSI that he's proud of his record. "I really believe I'm leaving El Cajon better than when I came into it," he says. He credits programs such as crime-free community housing, Neighborhood Watch, and other community policing programs that engage the community to help fight crime that helped drop even violent crime rates. He called situations such as Ferguson, Missouri's unrest a wake-up call that shows the importance of engaging the community and building public trust. The El Cajon Police Department has not been without controversy, however, notably a sexual harassment claim that remains pending. The department drew criticism from some community activists for demoting but not firing a sergeant accused of texting nude photos of himself to women who worked for him. However, City Manager Doug Williford has stated that responsibility for hiring and firing in the police department rests with him, not the police chief. Chief Redman has indicated that he looks forward to traveling and enjoying his hobbies, which include woodworking and restoring classic cars. His replacement has not yet been named. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Last week, East County Magazine reported on the United States Forest Service's announcement that it will now allow its new tanker firefighting planes to land at the Ramona Air Base. The USFS says the runway is not long enough. However, CAL FIRE provided a video showing a CAL FIRE pilot landing the same type of plane in Ramona. Now, all five of San Diego's congressional representatives, Duncan Hunter, Daryl Issa, Scott Peters, Juan Vargas, and Susan Davis, have signed a letter to Chief Thomas Tidwell of the USFS asking him to take action. County supervisors are asking the Obama administration to intervene. Supervisors Diane Jacob and Bill Horn have requested that at least one air tanker be allowed to operate out of Ramona during the county's wildfire season. The Forest Service's more powerful next-gen air tankers are used at San Bernardino International Airport, where they land and reload with 3,000 gallons of fire retardant to aid firefighting efforts across Southern California. Congressman Duncan Hunter's letter states a next-gen tanker successfully used Ramona Airport during a fire event in 2013 with a payload of nearly 2,200 gallons. By allowing these next-gen tankers to land and reload at Ramona, fire experts estimate that the aircraft can make 8 additional runs per day, improving the capability to save lives and property, Hunter's letter adds. Local residents are well aware of the importance of battling fires early, since our region has weathered 2 of the worst firestorms in California history, the 2003 Cedar Fire and the 2007 firestorms, both of which started right here in San Diego's East County. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
Friday was a rough day for motorists in East County. A motorhome sparked a dozen spot fires along Highway 67, forcing closure of the state highway and long delays for motorists while firefighters worked to douse the blazes. But even longer delays were experienced by motorists along Highway 94, which was shut down for roughly 10 hours after a semi-truck collided head-on with another vehicle carrying several passengers and rolled over. Inadequate notifications from official channels left motorists stuck in traffic for hours during extreme heat over 100 degrees on Highway 94, where an ambulance was forced to take a lengthy detour, too. "Something is wrong here," says Kim Hamilton, editor of the Dearborn Valley Antler. The publication's Antler Alerts provided the most reliable source of information during most of the extended shutdown. Not only was the primary artery and evacuation route closed, but there was little media coverage of it while it was taking place, she says. The accident was first reported at 10:23 a.m. Friday on Highway 94 at Marin Valley Road. Hamilton says the Caltrans site showed a SIG alert icon but had no mention under the problem areas section. California Highway Patrol's incident page had conflicting and at times inaccurate information. East County Magazine sent an alert relying on CHP information, which indicated one lane had reopened, but we later learned from multiple residents that it had not. Medics attempted to reach a crash east of Dulzura, and they were denied access, multiple sources have informed East County Magazine. Donnie Durfee says a request to follow an ambulance through that needed to get to Tecate for a patient was denied access and told to go around, as the road was completely blocked. Going around means going all the way to I-8 and exiting at Buckman Springs. They ended up sending an ambulance in from Campo, said Durfee. It is unclear why a medical helicopter was not dispatched to aid that patient or patients in the Tecate-Dulzura area. Durfee says motorists had to backtrack from a closure at Marin Valley Road after driving all the way down 94, only to learn they had to backtrack to the 188 intersection when they were ordered to turn around, at least a 30-minute additional delay. People also posted complaints about the situation on the Brush Fire Party Line Facebook page. One person posted at 8 p.m. in the evening, "My dad is diabetic and they are trying to figure out how to get home since 2 p.m. today." Residents did post helpful hints for each other on the Brush Fire Party Line about potential detour routes, but no such information was forthcoming from any official sources. It is unclear why the CHP, sheriff, or other source did not notify media with a press release, nor did the public learn via a Nixcel alert, nor even detour signs during much of this lengthy saga. Running out of gas or water in the extreme heat was a serious concern for motorists trapped hours in traffic, some with no air conditioning. But the greatest fear in this tinder-dry region is what would happen if a wildfire occurred during a prolonged traffic delay. Hamilton states that Highway 94 is the only way in and out for thousands in the East County, including those living in the 1,500 homes that SDG&E has labeled at highest risk of catastrophic fire, such as Dearborn Valley, Dulzura, Barrett, and Potrero. With the Hollywood Hamul Casino under construction now and an expanded border crossing at Otay expected to increase traffic on the already trouble-prone highway even more, residents are smoldering with concerns. Hamilton cites examples of at least a half dozen other incidents that caused delays of several hours or more along Highway 94 in the last 2 years. Some roadway improvements are planned or underway on Highway 94, in part due to casino mitigation. But residents have expressed concerns at a Caltrans meeting just earlier this month that such changes are not adequate in their view. While many in the community have fought to oppose the casino, one thing surely both sides can agree on is that hours-long delays when a major crash occurs can only be bad for both business at a casino as well as for residents who live in the communities that rely on Highway 94 as their major access route. East County Magazine has asked the California Highway Patrol for an explanation on why the closure on Highway 94 lasted for 10 hours, why there was no notification to the media or the public, and what can be done to prevent such dangerous delays in the future. We will also be reaching out to state and local officials to ask about solutions to not only spare residents long delays in the future, but potentially save lives. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
A midair collision of two small planes near Brown Field at Otay Mesa on Sunday killed four people and started a brush fire. A CHP officer told dispatchers that debris was scattered everywhere after the late morning crash, which sent smoke billowing up that was visible from State Highway 125 and across Southeast County. The debris sparked multiple spot fires as the planes fell to earth about a mile apart. San Diego Fire and Rescue crews doused flames at the crash sites while Cal Fire and Chula Vista Fire departments assisted in battling the brush fire. A Chula Vista firefighter was hospitalized for heat exhaustion, according to Cal Fire. The planes that collided were a twin-engine Sabre liner and a single-engine Cessna 172, both reportedly inbound for Brown Field. Cause of the crash has not yet been determined by the Federal Aviation Administration, and the identities of the victims have not yet been released. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. My guests are Miguel Angel Soria and Peter Alcatib. They are with the Diego Valley Charter School in El Cajon, and they are also the co-producers of the new film, Chaldean Voices. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Happy to be here.
Let's start by talking about the Charter School. When was it started, and what is its mission?
The charter school opened up in March of 2013, so it's been open for just a little over 2 years now. And its mission is really to work with dropouts and at-risk youth to try to help them achieve their high school diploma.
And what percentage of these former dropout and at-risk youth are actually achieving that diploma through your school?
80% of our students actually graduate with a high school diploma and go on to some sort of career pathway or college.
Excellent. That's very impressive. Now, a high percentage, I understand about 30 to 40% of your student population is Iraqi Chaldean students. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And it's a very diverse population. Tell us who else is there.
Yes. In addition to Chaldean immigrants, we have Latinos, African Americans, some Native Americans. It's a really, really diverse group of students.
What are you doing differently than the traditional high schools to help these at-risk students succeed?
In the traditional school setting, you'll see a lot of the classroom settings. In our schools, you'll see more of a one-on-one personalized learning model. So the students will come in and have 1 hour appointments with their teachers every week while they will go over their lesson plan, their homework, and they'll take a test. In addition to the one-on-one services with the teacher, we also have tutoring available. We have counselors on site, and it's more of a flexible schedule. So the students aren't required to be with us a certain amount of hours a day. They can come in for those who are working or have to raise children. It offers them that flexibility.
Yeah, the film, which I saw the premiere of recently, really tugged at your heartstrings a little bit and showed you what some of these students go through. It tracked, I believe, four of your students, and some of these kids were working just night and day. They're getting 2 hours sleep a night, trying to work to support their family or themselves while they're going to school. So it's amazing, I think, that they're doing as well as they are. Let's turn to you, Miguel. Now, you have a background in filmmaking, and you're a teacher at the school. Tell us a little bit about your filmmaking history, and then we'll go and talk about the movie.
I guess I've been involved in the arts since a very early age. My family is a very artistic family in Tijuana. They were involved in the avant-garde theater movement, and also there were some of the founders of the Tijuana Musicians Union. Mm. And so I come from very community-based activist art perspectives. And I first started off in theater, but I branched into filmmaking about 15 years ago.
And you were part of the Taco Shop Poets. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, the Taco Shop Poets was a group that was founded in 1994, and we performed poetry and music all throughout the nation for over 10 years. And we performed, the reason we were called the Taco Shop Poets is because we performed at taco shops. And so, you know, we performed in taco shops in New York, in San Francisco, in Chicago, in, you know, Seattle, you name it, we were there. And also in traditional cultural spaces, you know.
Very interesting. And I see that you've also been program director for the New Americans Museum in San Diego, which celebrates immigrants who have arrived in the United States ever since World War II. So that said, what was the inspiration to create the film Chaldean Voices?
Yeah, for me, yeah, I was the former program director for the New Americans Museum, but I've been involved with the immigrant rights movement since my college days. And to me, much like the mission of the New Americans Museum, which is to celebrate the immigrant experience, I saw that as being something central. And I think that America draws its strength from its diversity. Mm-hmm. And so any opportunity that I can get to really celebrate that message is key. And I want to take a part of it. And so when Peter approached me about this, I was more than eager.
Very good. And I understand this is going to be airing soon on KPBS television. Can you tell us when and where it'll be seen?
Mm-hmm. On KPBS, it'll be shown on September 1st at 11 a.m., and then it'll also be shown on September 6th.
And also it's going to be shown right here in El Cajon during the first ever Chaldean American Month, I understand. Mm-hmm. And that'll be shown on September 19th and 20th.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Where exactly will it be?
The Chaldean Festival will be held in Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon on September 19th and 20th. But it's actually the fifth annual festival. But this will be the first ever Chaldean American Month celebration.
And the film actually documented a very interesting lesson in civics that some of these new Americans received. Tell us a little bit about that.
One of the teachers at Diego Valley, Bryn Evans, social studies teacher, challenged her students to create a real life civic engagement project. And what the students decided to do was to begin the process of having the city proclaim the month of September as Chaldean American Month in El Cajon.
Yeah, and this is coming on the heels at the time this whole idea came about. El Cajon had some negative press. They had a former mayor, Mayor Lewis, who resigned after making statements that some viewed as racist toward Chaldeans. Mm-hmm. And there's a new mayor, of course, Bill Wells, who has reached out somewhat more to the Chaldean community, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, you decided to have the students lobby the city council to declare September Chaldean American Month. And how did that go?
It was an interesting process. So we initially approached the mayor about it, mm-hmm. Bill Wells, and he was very supportive of it. And we all thought that it wouldn't be too much of an issue. It's just the students would ask for it, and we'd see if it was either approved or denied. But what we found is that when we actually approached city council the day of, what we were expecting would last about 15 minutes, lasted about 2.5 hours, because there were some people there who were really fighting against it.
Speakers on both sides, correct. Interesting.
But then in the end, the students ended up winning with a 4-1 vote in favor of.
Ironic that the one vote against it came from the newly appointed Chaldean councilwoman, Star Bales, and her reasoning was that she felt that the city should be more inclusive, that if you were going to have a Chaldean American Month, maybe it should be a day, but you could also celebrate all the other ethnicities and minorities mm-hmm. that the city had. So it was interesting. I think she was trying to bend over backwards, not to look like she was showing favoritism to one group that she came out of herself. So, but it was a very interesting exercise, I think, in the democratic process.
Yes, yes. For a lot of the students, this is the first time they could even participate in a democratic process.
So. Yeah. So of the four students that you tracked in the film, can you tell us what's happened to them since they graduated?
One of our students, actually, Kristen McHale, has gone on to get her pharmacy technician license. She's actually working in a local Rite Aid here in El Cajon. And she's hoping to pursue enrolling in the nursing program at San Diego State University.
Very nice. And how about the other three?
Noir, the poet, he continues to write these mm-hmm. beautiful poems. He's also almost finished with his high school diploma. And then you have Sanand, mm-hmm. who he's going more the small business route. Mm-hmm. So he's looking to begin his own small business here in El Cajon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as many immigrants have done here successfully.
Exactly. Right. And then we have Lubna still working, I think, 10 jobs.
She was amazing.
Yeah. And going to school, you know, so yeah. she's still plugging away, and doing great.
Yeah.
So yeah, everybody's still in a very positive space mm-hmm. and they continue to basically see the film as one of the milestones, a huge milestone in their life because of the way that we were able to portray the story.
Yeah. Now, I understand that up until now, the film showings have been free everywhere, but that you have some plans to bring some revenue in that would be used to benefit future students at the school. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. We're actually in the process of creating DVD copies of the film, which we're hoping to sell to raise scholarship money for students who are graduating.
Very good.
And that will be available at chaldeanvoices.com.
Chaldean Voices, Chaldean Voices.com. Excellent. And if people want to learn more about the Diego Valley School, which is part of the Learn for Life network, mm-hmm. where can they get that information?
For the school, they can visit www.diegovalleycharter.org. Mm-hmm. And for our network, they can visit www.learnforlife.com. And that's the word learn, the word for spelled out, and the word life.
Okay.
It's a nonprofit, fully WASC accredited high school diploma program.
Thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and today it's our honor and special privilege to have the chairwoman of the Jamul Indian Village with us, Ms. Erica Pinto. Welcome.
Thank you, Leon. Good morning.
And we have with us Richard St. Jean, the general manager of the Hollywood Casino Jamul.
Thank you, Leon. Nice to be here.
It's nice to have the two of you here. There's been so much activity out there in Jamul. Every time I drive by, springing from the earth is this Hollywood Jamul Casino. Before we begin talking about the casino, I'd like to talk to you, Chairwoman Pinto. As the first woman chairperson of Jamul Indian Village, tell us a little bit about your history.
Yes, I'm the first elected woman of the Jamul Indian Village. I've been on council since I was 21, and that was in 1996. I've been in the background of the tribal council, and I'm now the elected chairwoman. And it's a whole different ballgame to be where I'm at.
What did you start out doing?
I started out as a secretary for the tribe. The former chairman, who is my uncle, Raymond Hunter, he gave me that opportunity to come in and answer phones and file. And I did. And then I thought, I'm going to run for council. At 21, I got in council. And I've been in ever since.
Were you the youngest ever?
Yes, I was both the youngest and the first woman.
And the first woman. And did you grow up in the village?
I did. I grew up in the village from 75 to the early 80s.
What was that like?
It was a whole other world being there. And from coming off the reservation to, it was very poor. But we were happy, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
We had nothing, but I had my mother, my father, my brothers, right. And we were happy there.
Yes. I grew up in Cass Lake, Minnesota. We were poor, dirt floors, some of our homes. And that was the way it was in the Jamul Indian Village in the 70s and the 80s?
Dirt floors, no electricity, no running water, well water. We drink well water. And so when electricity came in and the plumbing came in, we were so happy to be able to go to the bathroom indoors.
Uh-huh.
No black widows.
You were run out of your home one time by black widows?
We were run out of the outhouse by black widows. They used to like to sit in the bottom.
You went to which school there?
I went to Oak Grove Middle School, and then I went to Valhalla.
As the new tribal leader, what's your vision for any new direction in which you'd like to lead the tribe?
My vision and my hope as the leader of the tribe is to allow the tribe to become self-sufficient, economically independent, and be able to venture out into other businesses after we open 2016. And once we start generating revenue, I hope it's going to bring on a lot of opportunities for the tribe to expand our land base, to build housing, to get better health care, to allow the children and adults who want to go to school to get that education. So I hope to diversify once we start generating revenue.
The Jamul Indian Village has had a long history in East County. Can you tell us a little bit about the history?
Sure. We can trace our roots back 12,000 years. We were federally recognized in 1981. Originally there were about 23 people in the village, and now there's 53 tribal members, and we're continuing to grow, which is why this project is so important for us, and able to get better housing and better health and better education. And we're continuing to grow.
And what are you doing about reviving the Kumeyaay, Jamul Indian cultural heritage?
Well, my brother and I run a program called Acorns to Oaks. And that is a program that we get all the kids of the tribe, and we open it up to other reservations. And we programs that focus on the culture, making gourds. Gourds are what bird singers use for the cultural songs, the traditional songs. And we focus on technology. We focus on life skills. We focus on drugs and alcohol, making sure they don't go that route. So that's how we're trying to revive our culture, is through a series of classes and different programs that my brother Chris and I run.
And for the community, when the casino opens, that will open up some opportunities for employment in the area. Can you tell us something about that?
Sure. First and foremost, that will open up our employment for tribal members. And then I think we're going to have about 1,000 jobs that will, you know, be on the website. If you look right now, there's all kinds of jobs that are available and will become available once we open in mid-2016.
And our goal is obviously to hire locally first and foremost, and then expand the search from there. So very committed to hiring locally, buying locally, and supporting local businesses.
What can you tell us about the traffic? Can you tell us a little bit about what's being done to mitigate that?
Yes, Penn National, the Jamul Indian Village, Caltrans have been working very closely on the impact studies and the resulting modifications to SR Route 94. They've got a great plan. They've been terrific to work for. As a matter of fact, they had the public hearing just this Wednesday evening that was, you know, not attended by a great number of people, about 80, 85 residents from the Jamul area. Some very interested in how it may or may not impact, others, you know, more vocal about the project. But Caltrans is very excited to, you know, be near that in the end of that process to start that road work so we can get much of it done before our opening in the summer of 2016. So I think that from the site working backwards on 94 towards Rancho San Diego, you'll see some neat improvements that should help alleviate those concerns.
I saw that on your website that the road would be widened in certain places. There would be turn lanes added. There would be better signage and signals.
That's right. I think some of the bigger concerns are obviously the cross-traffic movement, so relative to left turns from the right lane, so on and so forth. So that's where, you know, they're widening, they're adding turn lanes and the lights in order to create a safer environment at the intersections, which allow for better flow for the people driving through.
Well, what are some of the exciting things we're going to see in this new Hollywood casino?
Oh, it's a very, very exciting project. And, you know, JIV has been very responsive to, you know, public feedback and reducing the height of the building, you know, muted earth tones, down lighting. So although it looks like a big building from the road when it's said and done, and for those that have seen renderings, it's a beautiful exterior that really blends well with its surroundings. A great sense of arrival. It's a property that's easy to get to, closest proximity to downtown. Great flow for an 8-story subterranean parking garage that we're building simultaneously with a casino floor. But we'll feature 1,700 slots, 50 table games, so not extraordinarily large casino floor. It'll be supported by a food court that we hope to partner with local restaurateurs to bring a local flavor into our food court. Mm-hmm. We're very close to penciling a deal with a local sports celebrity, which we are very anxious to announce in the near future.
Oh.
We'll have an Asian restaurant with traditional Asian offerings. And then we'll have the Hollywood Casino Final Cut Steak and Seafood, ooh, which is our signature restaurant we have in many of our Hollywood properties. And then we'll have a beer garden, indoor-outdoor mixed-use facility featuring local and international brews.
Oh, wow.
That overlook the beautiful landscape. And then we'll have an entertainment lounge on the casino level that we're very excited to start exploring local acts and featuring local groups. So it's got all the neat amenities. It's not a huge casino, so it'll be a little more intimate. We'll really focus, again, on partnering locally, hiring locally, and offering local products.
So it's going to have this Hollywood in the 60s type of glitz to it?
More the 30s.
Like very the golden age of bright. Hollywood, right?
And I welcome anyone to look up HollywoodCasino.com, and they can see it's taken on the traditional look of many of our other properties like Toledo, Columbus, our Speedway property, but it's got a little bit of a more modern touch than some of our other properties.
Well, maybe I could ask you this, since you come from a similar project in Ohio.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience there working, creating a casino in Ohio?
Well, those were state-run or they weren't tribal casinos.
Oh, okay.
However, being new to the state, there was your expected opposition. A lot of people were excited. It was voted by public referendum to have gaming. And we came in and we heard the positive and we heard the negative, the concerns about crime and things of that sort. When in fact, when we got there, we heard the concerns. When I left almost 3 years later to the day, I received a proclamation from the mayor of Rossford from the adjoining city for the many things we did to support his city, which we weren't necessarily housed in, such as providing money for fireworks, providing money towards their schools, helping a lot of fundraisers. People's houses would burn down. We'd immediately have our team members go to their aid and bring clothes, food. We paid for their police dog, which helped them recover confiscate lots of drugs and drug money, which that money flowed right back to their police department. So it was just a great story in developing a relationship where, we did it because that's our culture, not because we had to do it.
Right, exactly. And back to you, Chairwoman Pinto. What is your theme that you mentioned you have?
You mean hungry, homeless, and recovery?
Yes. Tell us about that.
We, the tribe and Penn, have reached out to a couple of nonprofit organizations, and right now we are trying to partner with them. We can't partner with them financially, but we can donate our time. A few weeks ago at the Crisis House, we helped to unload pallets of canned goods and drinks that came to the Crisis House, and we've committed to being there every fourth Tuesday. And same with the Madeline Center, St. Madeline Sophie Center, and Noah's Homes.
Noah's Homes being right up the street, we see a great opportunity for employment. We've met with Holly, the executive director, and we think that'll be a very natural fit because obviously those residents go out in the community, work all day, and then come home to their group living. So that seems like a very logical partnership right within Hamul.
Yes.
These are all nonprofits that we feel that we can relate to.
Looking into the future seven generations, what do you hope to see for the Hamul Indian Village tribal members and for the community?
I hope to see healthy tribal members. I hope that they will not have the worry that we had growing up or my parents had. I want them to be able to be self-sufficient in all they do, in their housings, in their educations. Wherever their path takes them, I want them to not worry and have any concerns of, are they going to be able to do this or go to school or wear shoes to be able to go to school. I want a worry-free tribe.
And the community?
And the community is going to benefit too. They're going to have safer roads, a nice state-of-the-art fire station and equipment.
Yeah, the one thing I'd like to add too is, as we've seen in virtually every jurisdiction, that the local businesses benefit. And when you start driving 3 million visitors a year, give or take, to a particular facilities, whether it's a mini marts, the gas stations, the car wash, the restaurants, and we've met with many of the local operators and most are very excited and truly see the benefit of this business coming to their community, and they will, their business will grow organically, and those always turn out to be a nice story, in addition to the philanthropic activities and partnerships. So I think all the way around, it's going to be we'd love to be here a year post-opening telling you about the actual successes.
Well, you're invited back 1 year from today. We'll put it on our calendar.
Good.
Yep. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that either of you'd like to talk about or?
From an employment perspective, which I think is on everybody's mind because there's still people looking for jobs, we expect to hire many of our managers by, third and fourth quarter of this year. And by, first quarter of 16, you'll really start to see job fairs, educating, people and residents about the type of jobs we offer and the skills required. And really that big employment push come Q1 of next year. So, jobs are coming to Hamul. We're looking for good people.
Well, I sure thank you both for being with us. I really appreciate it. And we look forward to more progress out in Hamul and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ. For the past 43 years, Gary McClintock has been making saddles to outfit trail riders and cowboys across our region. But on August 14th, the master saddlemaker passed away at his Descanso home, and with his passage, a large part of San Diego's Western history and heritage rides off into the sunset. He was seriously injured in October 2014 in a motorcycle accident, breaking multiple ribs, among other injuries. The local equestrian community rallied around McClintock at that time, holding fundraisers to help cover his medical bills. His website for McClintock Saddleworks has been shut down, but his memory lives on at a Facebook page where friends have shared their recollections. Lakeside Rodeo posted this tribute. He touched so many, many people's lives through his art of saddlery, leather goods such as chaps, or just as a friend. His craftsmanship, his artisanal skills were renowned, and his legacy of both talent and friendship will always remain in our hearts. Horse of the Sun Ranch posted this epitaph. Gary was a true cowboy, and we always appreciated his vision and participation in keeping the culture and traditions of the vaqueros alive for present and future generations. McClintock's handcrafted saddles sold for as much as $10,000 each, with a waiting list a year long. But for many horse riders around the world, that wait was a small price to pay for owning a piece of history from one of the West's true great craftsmen. His passage marks the end of an era. McClintock has said he believed he was the last full-time saddlemaker in San Diego County. To the family and friends of Gary McClintock in Descanso, from all of us at KNSJ Radio, which broadcasts from the heart of East County in Descanso, we extend our deepest condolences. East County Magazine's Sound of History host, Helen Ofield, interviewed Gary McClintock 2 years ago in a two-part series, and today seems a fitting time to honor his memory by replaying part one in that series when he spoke in depth about his saddle-making craft.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. The sound of hoofbeats, the smell of sagebrush, the brilliant blue sky overhead. This is the world of my guest today, Gary McClintock, president of McClintock Saddleworks in Descanso, and one of East County's most famous residents. McClintock is to saddles what Willie Shoemaker was to horse racing. Their skills are enormous and particular. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Helen. That's well said and a little overstated, but thank you so much for such a nice introduction.
Oh,
I appreciate that.
Never, Gary, never overstated. I think you're one of the most popular people in East County and in the horse world.
I hope I don't have to live up to that.
You're such a Westerner, but where were you born and how long have you lived in East County?
Well, actually, I was born in Santa Monica, California, so I've lived my whole life in California. Came to San Diego in the 60s for college and have moved out to East County about that same time and kind of felt that this was a nice spot for me, so I've been there ever since.
So you were a city boy.
We lived on the beach, actually, Helen.
Oh, golly.
In a place called Playa del Rey. So we started on the coast of California in the 50s. I was born in 1948, and we lived in a little place called Playa del Rey, which is right on the coast, underneath the airport, pretty close to that.
My goodness, this makes you a quintessential Californian because you have experienced everything from the coast, the beautiful coast, the freeways, the incessant traffic, the smog. And what lured you to East County, to Descanso?
Well, actually, I was here for college at San Diego State.
Oh, yes.
And at that time, I actually moved to East County with a group of friends that college students that needed a place to live, and we found a little place in Pine Valley back in about 1967, 68.
I have seen your custom saddles, and they are stunning. How long have you been making saddles?
Well, actually, Helen, we started in 1973, so this is my 40th year. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary right now. This is actually 40 years of building saddles.
What drives a young man to want to do that?
I think the desire to live out of town was the start. I wanted to work with my hands. I come from a family of dentists who also work with their hands, you see. But it was kind of a kickback of the hippie era, and had to get out of town and live in the mountains and be away from the city. And it stuck with me. And I found saddles was something a friend recommended that I could. We were making belts before that. And then the recommendation came along, and I went to a school to learn how to build them, because it was something I could do on my own, one at a time. I didn't have to be a factory or a manufacturer, which is what we became as belt makers. We got to the point where we were manufacturing belts for Pennies and Sears and people like that. Then I thought, no, I just want to be the custom little maker that I seen down in Mexico, to tell you the truth, down in San Blas, Mexico, on a surfing voyage. We were down in the square there and observed some artisans making belts and handbags and saddles. Well, not saddlebags, sandals. And then handbags. So we had the opportunity to enjoy that and thought, well, this guy has a pretty decent lifestyle right here on the coast. He can just do what he wants and sell it and catch waves when...
There's a real cultural context for this. The 1970s are often referred to as the time of the rebirth of the American craftsman. And there was a tremendous interest at that time in the handcrafted item. And actually, who was in the White House then? Mrs. Mondale.
Oh, really?
Yeah, made a big deal about bringing handmade pottery into the White House and serving dinners and whatnot on things made by artisans from America. So you were right in that groove. On average, if there is an average, how long does it take to design and make a Western saddle?
It's a good 7-day project. It takes a good 7 days to complete it. As long as it doesn't have a lot of the floral tooling, the carving or tooling, that takes somewhat more time. You could put another 40 hours into that if it was fully carved, you know, with the carving that you see, the floral decoration.
So someone comes to you and says, I must have a Western saddle. It needs to look in a certain way. It's on this particular kind of horse.
Exactly. I get a lot of people that come to me because they can't find first something that's going to work for their horse. So I accommodate that particular type of a horse by fitting the horse, you might say. I go out and take a look at it, which is what I'm going to do this afternoon. I'm on my way to Ramona this afternoon to take a look at a guy's horse and make sure that we get the right size saddle for him. His vet recommended that he come to me because I have a reputation of accommodating that type of a need. So that's where a lot of it starts there. A lot of it starts with people who can't find the style of saddle they prefer, let alone the size seat that fits them in that style with that fit for the horse. So there's three features there that they have to accommodate, and your typical manufactured products don't do that.
You know, when I was researching this topic, I came across a man who chewed the leather and pounded it with a mallet to make it pliable. And I assume you are not chewing the leather, but if you are, don't hesitate to share. Where do you get saddle leather? And do you have a favorite kind?
Well, there's a couple of tanneries left in the United States. The best tannery for that particular type of a vegetable tan leather, it's quite thick leather. It's done back in St. Louis. They do the best quality for saddles. There's been others, and there still are other makers, but a lot of EPA, Environmental Protection Agency stuff, has driven certain tanneries out of different areas like Los Angeles. There was quite a few makers there. A lot of it's being done in China, Mexico, out of the state and imported back. But the particular leather that I use comes out of St. Louis, Missouri, the Herman Oaks Tanning Company. So it's made here in the United States still. And it's just a real good quality leather all the way around. For all the features I need. I mean, I need a certain thickness. I need a leather that will tool easily, mold easily to the tree that I make the saddle upon.
Okay, the tree is the wooden...
It's the wooden frame that's been covered with rawhide. Okay. Rawhide is untanned leather.
Gary, is there any one saddle maker in history who inspired you?
Not an individual, but a company called the Visalia Saddle Company of California. I became, along the way, I got quite interested in historical stuff, California stuff, California Vaquero. I was consulted by a member, a guy named Ibanez from the Times newspaper up in Los Angeles. He requested a saddle out of this old catalog. This is like maybe 1975, 76, and it had some particular decoration on it that was braiding. It was rawhide braiding, and I just loved the look of it. And so I, from his request, I had to learn how to do all this stuff. And I went to, here in San Diego, there was a gentleman in the mountains out in Descanso named Granville Martin. And I spent time with him learning how to prepare this rawhide and then how to apply it to the saddle and make a nice decorative trim on the saddle, which is what Visalia used to do.
Nice.
And I thought, well, this is great. And so I've done a lot of saddles over the years that have that rawhide trim on it.
Gary, is it fair to say that your saddles are all over the United States?
Oh, absolutely.
All over North America?
Europe, quite a few there. Quite a few in... Northern Mexico. I sold saddles to cowboys and vaqueros down in, starting in about Tecate and maybe down as far as Ensenada. And I know there's even further, about halfway down the peninsula where we filmed the video, Corazon Vaquero, there's a couple of guys down there that I traded some saddles for.
Gary, that's a great segue. We're going to come back and renew this conversation. We're almost out of time. But Gary is not riding off into the sunset just yet. We're going to continue this conversation next time. Sit around, maybe chew some leather.
Probably not, hopefully, right?
Gary McClintock, thank you for coming. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield. You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Leon Thompson with an education report. California's Department of Education is being sued for denying access to records on the number of students who are English language learners. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area and Public Counsel has filed a lawsuit in Sacramento County Superior Court to obtain the records pursuant to the California Public Records Act. No state agency is above the law, said Travis Silva with the Lawyers Group, the Sacramento Bee reports. The Department of Education told the Bee it had not reviewed the case yet and would reserve comments. Records on English learner students are crucial to monitor schools' progress, among other things. The case could have ramifications locally, since San Diego and East County are home to many immigrant and refugee students from Iraq, Mexico, and other places who are English as a second language students.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A horse statue stolen from a front yard in Alpine is back home with its owner. The $650 bronze and copper decorative horse was found on a dirt road near the 700 block of South Glen Oaks Road in Alpine just after 9 a.m. on Saturday. A driver passing by saw the horse statue on the road and called the Alpine Sheriff's Station after recognizing the horse from a community safety bulletin. Daisy, as her owners call her, has a few dents, but she's not damaged, the Sheriff's Department reports. There are no surveillance cameras in the area, and it's not clear who left Daisy on the road, but she was dusted for fingerprints before being returned to her happy owner. The investigation is ongoing, and anyone with information on who stole Daisy is urged to call the Alpine Sheriff's Station at 619-659-2600.
Local student filmmakers may soon take home top honors in the motion picture industry. The National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Pacific Southwest Chapter has nominated 3 films produced by students at San Diego State University for Emmy Awards in the Student Programming category, the SDSU News Center reports. The nominees include Anything But Frogs, a romantic comedy in the long-form category produced, directed, and written by David O'Leary. The other films were nominated in the short-form category. The Infirmary is a science fiction work by Taylor Sedensky, and Smile is a comedy produced by Jason Miller. No doubt the nominations will bring smiles to the faces of each of these talented student filmmakers. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
This is Leon Thompson with a public service announcement from the City of La Mesa. Applications are being accepted for several openings on La Mesa's Youth Advisory Commission. Applicants must live within the city limits of La Mesa and be at least 13 years old, but not more than 20. Participating on the commission is a good way for young people in middle and high school to work with their peers to explore activities that promote positive youth relations in the city and gain volunteer experience that can be applied towards community service hours. Being a commission member also looks great on college and job applications, the city points out. Commission meetings are held on the second and fourth Monday of each month at 4:30 p.m. in the Community Center on Memorial Drive in La Mesa. Applications must be returned to the City Clerk's office no later than 5:30 p.m. on Friday, September 4th, to be included in interviews on September 22nd. Applications may be obtained from the City of La Mesa's website or at City Hall. For more information, you can also call the city clerk at 667-1120.
Many wildfires in California are caused by vehicles, including a dozen spot fires in Ramona that were caused by a towing chain on a motorhome igniting dry brush last week. Here are some tips for preventing your vehicle from accidentally starting a fire. Practice safe towing. A loose tow chain can cause sparks. Use a hitch ball with appropriate safety pins to secure a chain when towing a vehicle. Be sure your vehicle is properly maintained, with no parts dragging on the ground that could cause sparks. Maintain proper tire pressure, since driving on exposed rims can start a fire. If you have a flat tire, stop and call for help right away. Keep brakes in good condition. Worn brakes can cause metal on metal and ignite a fire. Never drive over or park on top of dry grass or brush. Hot exhaust pipes or mufflers can easily start a blaze. And finally, carry a fire extinguisher and be sure you know how to use it if needed. For more ways to prevent wildfires, you can visit wildfireca.org. This has been a public service announcement from East County Magazine.
This is Ed Barrena with a public service announcement from San Diego Gas and Electric. SDG&E has issued a reminder to the public about the importance of calling 811 before you dig. Last year, nearly 283 natural gas lines were damaged by third-party contractors or residents digging, which is an increase from that same time period in 2014. Calling 811 or Underground Service Alert will help avoid possible injury or damage to hidden gas lines or service interruption. Scott Ferguson, Vice President of Gas Operations at SDG&E, states, "Damaging a natural gas line can pose a significant safety risk and disrupt natural gas service. We ask everyone, whether digging at a construction site or at their homes, to make a quick 811 phone call to Underground Service Alert to have utility-owned lines marked for free. Before digging, residents, business owners, and contractors should mark the proposed excavation area and call 811 at least 2 business days before the project is scheduled to begin. Underground Service Alert will contact all local utilities for free to have them locate and mark the underground lines, pipes, and cables they own. For more information about safe digging or to submit an online request, visit digalert.org. If you suspect a gas emergency or have questions regarding a gas odor or carbon monoxide, call SDG&E immediately at 800-411-7343. It's important to keep in mind that natural gas is flammable and that something as simple as a spark can serve as an ignition source. Use your sense of sight, hearing, and smell and any of the following signs to alert you to the presence of a gas leak. Look for the following: dirt or water being blown in the air, dead or dying vegetation over or near pipeline areas, a fire or explosion near a pipeline, exposed pipeline after an earthquake, fire, flood, or other disaster, and bubbles in puddles outdoors after a rain. You should listen for an unusual sound such as a hissing, whistling, or roaring sound near a pipeline. And you should smell for the distinctive odor of natural gas. However, although SDG&E adds a distinctive odor to natural gas to aid in the detection of leaks, you should not rely on your sense of smell alone to determine if you have a gas leak. For more safety information, visit sdge.com/safety.
Uber is partnering with Life Reimagined, a subsidiary of AARP, to hire active seniors to become partner drivers. Nationally, Uber says it needs to add hundreds of thousands to its workforce, so Life Reimagined will offer workshops across California and information online to get people started. Adam Sohn with AARP calls the two organizations a natural fit, since the ride-sharing app allows seniors to monetize one of their biggest assets, their vehicle.
We thought that would be a really positive opportunity for people in the Life Reimagined community to earn additional income, to be more self-empowered, and maybe starting their own business by just taking their car out of their driveway.
Uber says more than half of its current drivers are over age 40, and 24% are over 50. To qualify to drive for Uber, you need insurance, a clean driving record, and a car that is fewer than 10 years old. Sohn says studies show that older people are more careful on the road than younger drivers, making them ideal candidates to drive for Uber.
Uber is also excited about the level of engagement from these more experienced drivers and the level of safety that the passengers will enjoy.
Part of the new agreement is that drivers who sign up for Uber through Life Reimagined get a $35 bonus after they complete 10 trips. Information is on either the Uber or Life Reimagined websites. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine. An avian flu outbreak has caused 48,000 chickens and other poultry to be put to death to prevent spread of the deadly disease, CBS News reports. That's caused the price of eggs to skyrocket and has left some restaurant owners scrambling to find substitute ingredients. 10 News reports that Pierre Owan, owner of the Ranch House restaurant in Santee, says his egg bill has jumped from $100 a week to $600 a week. Lakeside egg rancher Frank Hilliker says he's never seen egg prices so high. In California, the cost of complying with a new cage-free, humane egg farming law has also pushed prices upwards. Some restaurants have pulled key egg dishes off menus. Soup Plantation has yanked boiled eggs from its salad bars, and Panda Express is now serving up fried rice made without eggs. Nicole Reese is a former pastry chef who now works for Glanbia, a company that makes an egg replacement product, and now has its phones reportedly ringing off the hook as demand increases due to the egg shortage. But she admits, people like eggs. We would prefer to be using eggs. Yolks bring out moisture and richness in baked goods, while egg whites add structure to items such as sponge cakes, as well as flavor. While substitutes such as whey protein, bean protein, or algae can be substituted in some uses, none are all that they are cracked up to be. And to date, there is no perfect replacement for eggs.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.